Members, we're going to call the Health and Human Services Reform Committee meeting to order. And we don't have a quorum quite yet, so whenever we do get one, I'll just need to quickly interrupt in order to announce that. But we'll get started with our meeting today. And members, we have the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center here to present. Up first, it's going to be Dr. Brooks Jackson. And I've actually had the privilege over the last several months to sit on the Governor's Blue Ribbon Task Force for the University of Minnesota, and it's been a great experience in learning a lot about the priorities and initiatives of the university and the medical school as we continue to try to prepare the workforce for the growing needs in our health and human services world in Minnesota. And so I thought it would be just a great thing to, for the committee to hear as we continue to deal with issues, things we're going to be talking about this session with the workforce shortage, some loan forgiveness issues, mental health issues, and so wanted to the University of Minnesota in to give us an overview. And with that also, members, we're going to be wrapping up overviews here soon and hearing increasingly more bills, but I do just want to encourage members to get your bills in and introduced sooner than later. We have deadlines now in about eight-ish weeks until that first deadline. And so if you do the math, it's not a ton of committee hearings. And so we really want to start to be strategic with how we're getting things scheduled to get everything in. So just a friendly reminder to members. With that, I will turn it over to our testifiers. If you could introduce yourself for the record and then begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me in front of you today. For the record, I'm Brooks Jackson, the Dean of the Medical School and Vice President for Health Sciences. I am a physician and a pathologist with my clinical interests in transfusion medicine and transfusion-transmitted diseases, HIV diagnostics, prevention, and treatment as my background. I will provide the committee with an overview of the Academic Health Center, the Blue Ribbon Committee on the Medical School, and the 2015 biennial request for the health sciences. This slide shows that the university's Academic Health Center has six schools. This graph summarizes the six schools committed to meeting the health needs of Minnesota through education and training of the state's workforce, health research, and clinical care. These schools are the School of Dentistry, Medicine, Nursing, Pharmacy, Public Health, and Veterinary Medicine. The mission of the Academic Health Center is to prepare the next generation of health professionals who will care for our families and communities, discover and deliver new treatments, cures, and ways to promote health, and contribute to the economic vitality of our health industries in Minnesota. Some facts about the Academic Health Center. It's one of the most comprehensive health sciences centers in the nation. I just mentioned the six schools. It also has 20 interdisciplinary research and education centers, some 6,200 students in 62 programs, both professional, graduate, and undergraduate. We conduct over $400 million in health research annually and provide care for approximately 1 million patients annually. The professional education programs are listed on this slide, but this list only includes those programs with the largest enrollments, so it's not a comprehensive list, but does show the largest ones there. In terms of the health professions education, this is a education component that is highly regulated through accreditation standards, licensure, and certification requirements for practice and various health professions. Its high workforce demand is driven by an aging population. I think our population in Minnesota of those over 65 will double by the year 2030. It's driven by these retirements and health care reform. We have a high number of applicants, high retention, and high on-time graduation rates for these schools. However, it does take a long time to educate and train health professionals, both didactically and experientially. In terms of clinical and experiential learning, this includes using over 1,700 affiliated training sites across Minnesota and internationally. So we have training sites virtually, I think, in every county in Minnesota. We competencies are demonstrated through standardized patients and examinations. We use some of the most state-of-the-art simulation technology for competency development. And we are known for our interprofessional education and training and have the national grant in this area as well. As I said, it takes a long time to educate and train doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. The key point from these next couple slides is that decisions we make today on enrollments, curriculum changes, et cetera, will not be seen in the work care force for often 10 years. So it's not unusual, so for example, to train a physician that after college, that it takes roughly anywhere from 7 to 14 years for a physician to become trained in their given area. So it costs a lot of money to educate and train a health profession workforce. And this is true with virtually all of these health professions in the six schools. The training represented on this chart shows the number of hours of experiential education required for four of the healthcare professions in the AHC. It happens outside the traditional classroom under the direct supervision of a mentor or a teacher. So it's more akin to field training and is the reason we have affiliation agreements with over 1,700 community clinic and hospital sites in the state of Minnesota. This model also has the advantage of allowing us to recruit from communities and train in those communities, which increase the likelihood that the students will then practice in those communities. And it allows us to the opportunity to test and develop various models of care delivery that employ the various providers in different roles. It also makes us interdependent with the communities, clinics, and health systems, which become increasingly important, especially with some of the health care access issues in greater Minnesota in our underserved urban areas. In terms of enrollments, you can see here that this only includes enrollments for health professional programs, does not include graduate degrees. The medical school numbers do not include residents or mortuary sciences or physical therapy. For example, in the medical school, it's only the medical students, so there are roughly about 950 students at any given one time. According to the American Association of Medical Colleges, Minnesota has approximately 270 active physicians per 100,000 Minnesota residents. Minnesota, therefore, ranks about 13th among 50 states, and those numbers are based on the 2010 census with the study published in 2011. So you have some idea what our physician-to-population ratio is.
Dr. Jackson?
Yes.
If I could interrupt briefly, we have a question from Representative Loeffler.
Yes, Madam Chair. Your representative.
And thank you, Dr. Jackson. I just had a couple questions just so I can kind of understand. When you say the Academic Health Center, are you including the campus programs like at UMD, or is it just the Twin Cities campus when you refer to that?
No,
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and Representative.
Loeffler.
The Academic Health Center does include the Duluth campus. We have the College of Pharmacy has a campus there, as well as the School of Medicine. So those two are part of the academic health sciences overall.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for clarifying that. The other question I had is how well are we using the undergraduate time to prepare people for these professions? Like your slide shows that to get the PharmD degree now, it's 4 years post-undergraduate study in pharmacy and pharmacology. It used to be an undergraduate program for which you could then go on to additional training. Are we using that undergraduate program years to prepare them, or have we just shifted all the professional training to graduate school?
Dr. Jackson.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler. It's we are relooking at that whole thing about the time it takes to train health professionals and looking at whether we can actually shorten that and make that more efficient. So, for example, in the medical school, we are working with a 3-year undergraduate, 4-year medical school program, and is likewise in terms of the training time of medical school and residency that they do afterwards, shortening that so there would be less time in the residency program to become, say, in the medical school. So, for example, you would do 3 years of medical school instead of four and then do your pediatric residency in 3 years. So it would be six instead of seven. So we are looking at various ways we can shorten that training time and still have very competent, effective
physicians. And the other schools are looking at various options as well. And as you can see in the next slides, one of the reasons that's driving this is the debt load and the cost of education, as well as the ability to train more health professionals faster, because there is a growing need to provide the workforce, especially in certain geographic as well as in specialty areas, and just the whole aging population and level amount of chronic disease that our society is facing is really creating a demand for health professionals.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Jackson, could you just repeat really quick, you gave the ratio in Minnesota of physicians per certain amount of Minnesotans and then how that compares nationally. Could you just repeat that number for me,
yes,
briefly?
Yes, the exact number was 269.6, or about 270 active physicians per 100,000 population or resident population, and that ranks us about 13th among 50 states. I know the range is as low as about 161 per 100,000, which I believe was Idaho, and as high as 420 or 30 in Massachusetts.
Okay. And maybe a naive question, but is there an ideal ratio that's out there? Is it obvious that the lower the better, or is there a saturation point at which you're saying we're turning out too many doctors?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I think it would probably very much depend on the types of populations, diseases in your population, and it really does vary by state in many cases, as well as the dispersion of the population within a state would clearly make a difference.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that slide as well, I'm wondering if you could break out the number of physicians per 100,000 in the 7-county metro area versus greater Minnesota. If there's a, we're talking about the whole state, but is there a change or a dispersion difference as we talk about those two categories?
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and Representative, there is a difference, but I don't know the exact numbers, but it is a higher ratio in the Twin Cities area, for example, than in more rural areas.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jackson, thank you for that. And then if you could just speak to the graduation or certification, if you will, of specialists as opposed to general practitioners.
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and Representative, so Minnesota is actually well known for its training of primary care, family medicine, general internal medicine physicians. We really are ranked as one of the top medical schools for training in that area, and having a large number in the state. Having said that, there is still, I think most would consider, a maldistribution of we don't have enough primary care health professionals, whether it's physicians, nurses who are working in primary care, not just as an area of health, but both a maldistribution geographically as well. So I think there's sort of a maldistribution geographically and by specialty.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to follow on to that, if you could describe for me any trend line that you're seeing with the answer you just gave in terms of the maldistribution, and is it indicative of the cost to be trained, or is it the aspiration for a career that is not only motivated by finance and by a career that is economically rewarding, or what would you attribute that to? And in the context of just quite literally the healthcare system that has been developed over the last 40 years, if you could just speak to the bigger picture.
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think it clearly the debt of our students almost undoubtedly plays a factor in this, and in the next couple slides I will show you that.
Okay.
I think there are a number of other reasons that, say for example, physicians and other health professionals prefer working a metropolitan type area as opposed to rural areas, for example, just in terms of opportunities, job opportunities, flexibility options. I mean, there are all sorts of other social issues that why a physician, for example, may prefer working in an urban area than a rural area. But in terms of the specialty, though, given the debt I'm about to go over, I think that does influence the types of specialties they go into, because there are great differences in salaries between primary care physicians and highly specialized areas of medicine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You can continue, Dr. Okay. Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next slide shows the average student loans by degree on the next slide. This is the latest data from Central University Resources. And the average loan numbers are only those loans students take out while they are enrolled of one of our health professions. They do not include what debt students may have from their undergraduate education. So, for example, for the medical doctor, 91% of our students require financial aid. The average loan they take out in medical school is $162,000. But if you include the undergraduate debt they also incur, it's closer to about $186,000. And there's a big difference between, for example, the medical students in the Twin Cities. It's about $154,000. But in Duluth, for example, it's almost $200,000. It's significantly higher on that campus, for example. So I think that probably reflects the difference in family incomes of those who want to be in the Twin Cities and those who are more in the more rural, greater Minnesota areas. So it is very expensive, and there are great differences in salaries by specialty. So one could see that this does influence, I think, to some degree about that. And we only have about two full scholarships, for example, in the medical school. So there's not a lot of scholarship money available. So it really does come down to being able to get loans, federal loans, bank loans, family loans. To the next slide, there are several pages of maps in the next slide to illustrate how widespread the health professional shortages are in Minnesota through much of greater rural Minnesota and the central urban cores. Shortages in primary care, dentistry in particular, is really has a problem. Anesthesiology, mental health. So it shows you these next, and the next slide shows training of our students do occur in all of these areas, and one of the real advantages is so that they will learn about these communities and stay there. And we do have some incentive programs for them to do that, although we could do with more, I think. So,
Dr. Jackson, we have a question from Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jackson, before we move on, you've got the loans there. Will there be another slide in comparing the salaries of a graduate, a 5-year, a 10-year?
There is not another slide, but I can give you some examples, though, since I see salaries of lots of physicians. A primary care physician out of training may make $140,000 a year, whereas a cardiologist, interventional cardiologist, may be at $450,000, $500,000 and go up to $600,000. I mean, it can be 2 to 3 times fold the difference of some of our primary care. A more senior family medicine person, maybe it's $250,000, but compared to maybe a orthopedic surgeon or, like I said, interventional cardiologist, $700,000 maybe. So you can see there are big differences by these specialties. Now, those more specialized do take a lot longer for training. I will say that. I mean, it's a surgical subspecialty may take eight years, 10 years. Family medicine may take 3 years or 4 years. So,
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jackson, I guess the initially when we see these, anytime we see student loans, these numbers seem staggering, but this is an investment into their profession. So I guess we could, if we look at return on investment, whether your family practice or a specialty is can be measured in probably a few years.
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair, I think that is true, and certainly those that go into the high specialty areas and high paying areas, it is a good return on investment. But if we want more people to go into primary care and some of the lower paid ones, it does become, the return on investment is not very good.
Thank you.
We have a couple more questions on that. One other, just piggybacking off of that, is there any type of information out there that would say, on average, how long does it take for a primary care physician to take care of that debt versus a cardiologist versus a, you know, how long are they battling that debt before they're moving on from that and whatever they're earning is just going to their livelihood? Dr. Jackson.
I don't have the data. I'm sure we could get it. I can tell you personally, it took me 10 years, but it's real, though.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jackson, as you know, in the last biennium, we passed legislation to give nurse practitioners more independence. And one of the issues that was raised in support of that change in legislation was the need to have more primary care practitioners in the rural parts of the state. And my question to you is whether you know if anybody is tracking whether that is going to turn out to be true, and have you seen any evidence so far? I mean, it's been pretty recent change, granted. I just would like to hear if you have any comments on that change in policy with regard to how it's going to impact primary care availability in some of these shortage areas.
Dr. Jackson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, let me make sure I understand. This is talking about other health, expanding the scope of practice for other health professionals, not physicians. Is that what you're referring to?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, some people called it expanding the scope of practice. We're talking about nurse practitioners.
Yes.
It was mainly getting independent prescribing rights. I don't know if people may or may not think that's expanding the scope of practice. But the idea was that if they didn't need to have an agreement with a physician in order to practice, that we would see more of them going to the rural areas of the state and providing that primary care that we know we are missing in a lot of places. So I just wondered, and I realize your medical education, not the nursing side of things, but I just wondered if you're seeing anything or if you have any comments on that at this point.
Dr. Jackson.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. I don't think we have the data to know whether that has actually happened or not, but it certainly, the intention, I think, is by expanding the scope of practice for other health professionals, whether they be pharmacists or nurses, advanced nurse practitioners, that this will potentially help alleviate the shortages in some of these areas, because I think it would be difficult to do only by physicians. So I think that was the intent and the hope is one of the outcomes of that legislation. But I do not have, and I don't think we have the data to know whether that's actually happened or occurred at this point.
We have a question from Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious on a couple of things. One, that just a comment with the previous questioning here, how much primary care teams and the increase of scope for those team members can leverage doctors in outstate. That's more of a general, maybe later. But when you do give us information, maybe on some of the specialties, we should have the fuller picture of malpractice and other costs, because if you're in greater Minnesota, you might not be at a hospital that would have a global malpractice policy that you wouldn't see coming out of your funds, your salary. But in greater Minnesota, you may be having a rather large expense item that you wouldn't have, which may deter you from going there. So if you've got by region and different practice situations to give us a picture of the economic impacts and a fuller scope of what might contribute to discouraging certain locations.
Dr. Jackson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, I don't have that specific data. I am sure, though, that the cost of practice and some of these other factors that you mentioned, I would imagine, do have an effect on people's affecting people's choices about that, both economic factors as well as the overall other support you have around you, in terms of whether it's other health professionals or the types of infrastructure, such as the large medical center, would might affect your choice. I suspect it would.
We have a question from Representative Becker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards with, on the one slide, you saw a huge increase, somewhat huge, in nursery, school nursery. Did you see that increase because of nurse practitioners? And where does physician assistant apply? Would that be under the medical school with those degrees?
Dr. Jackson.
Well, the physician's assistants would not be in the medical school. We don't train physician assistants. The nursing school has seen a large increase. My understanding, and I can clarify this, but my understanding, it is more in the advanced nurse practitioners, DNPs, not in the BSN, undergraduate bachelor's of science of nursing.
Okay, thank you, doctor.
And we have one last question, and we'll let you go on with your presentation. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jackson, you know, you mentioned earlier the aging of society and the demands that we'll be putting on just with retirement of health practitioners, let alone the demand for patient visits. And I have heard, and just like to know, what are we doing in gerontology? Over the next 35 years, we're going to have gigantic increases in the number of elders, and yet I have heard that the university is actually not ramped up and perhaps is even retrenched a bit in its gerontology training.
So, Madam Chair, I think there's some truth to what you say there, and geriatrics is will be and is already a very important area that we do need to ramp up in that area. As I mentioned about the doubling of those over 65 years of age by 2030, many with chronic diseases and living longer, that's all true. And as you will see, as part of our biennial request, there is request for money for increased training programs for geriatricians, geriatrics in particular. So I am very supportive of ramping this up.
Representative Loeffler.
Great. Just to follow up, how many are you training currently?
Dr. Jackson.
So, right, Madam Chair and Representative, so geriatrics is embedded in family medicine and internal medicine. They get that as part of their training in internal medicine or family medicine, but it's not a distinct program, a separate specialty track, which is what we want to do.
Thank you.
Okay, and I just have to go back to one quick order of business, Dr. Jackson. Members, we do have a quorum present. If you could go back to your presentation, and we'll try to let you go a little bit longer now and probably preempt some of our questions. So thank you, Dr. Jackson.
Okay. On the slide on major challenges in health education. So most predictions for future health care provider needs have turned out to be wrong. If you look over the past 30 years, there have been many, many projections that have not turned out very well. The pipeline to develop new providers is long, as I have said, and the landscape changes constantly. The reimbursement disincentives for primary care are a major challenge. Primary care physicians and other providers are not compensated as well as specialists, as I've said. The reimbursement system is based on face time with patients rather than their health care. Our system is somewhat perverse in that we are not paid for wellness, it's really paid for treatments. So without adequate funding for education and training, we need to rely on tuition, and student debt continues to rise, creating another disincentive to choosing primary care. Finally, it is difficult, if not nearly impossible, for us to find additional clinical training and practice sites for our students and residents that actually model the way we think healthcare should be delivered.
in these interdisciplinary approaches. As much as we talk about new models of care, there are very few places where the models are practiced, and even fewer where we can send our students and residents to train. So we've been working to address the healthcare needs of Minnesota for many years and have increased enrollments to the extent we have been able, given the constraints of our faculty teaching facilities and training sites, and have expanded programs in Duluth and Rochester to train students in greater Minnesota, particularly in the Duluth area. Many of those are chosen students because they want to work in greater Minnesota. And we have developed and sustained pipeline programs to encourage high school and college undergraduates in health professional careers and to train our students through rural physician associate program and other programs in areas of health shortages to encourage them to practice in these communities when they graduate and complete their residency programs. The university and the academic health center have been working to address the healthcare needs for many years, and we believe we are being successful in a number of areas. We are a national leader in primary care. More of our students and residents are interested in primary care than other states and stay here to practice. Roughly about 70% of our physicians that we train from the medical school do stay in Minnesota, are practicing in Minnesota, and about 85% of health professionals have been at the University of Minnesota in some part of their training. So by primary care, I mean family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, med-peds, as well as dentists, nurses, and pharmacists. U.S. News and World Report ranks all of our schools highly among the top research-intensive medical schools. We are in the top three, along with Colorado and Washington. So we are ranked sixth overall in terms of medical schools for primary care, fourth in rural medicine, and 11th in family medicine. Our family medicine actually ranks third in the country for NIH funding and research as well. As I said, half of our medical students and residents choose primary care, and our Doctor of Nursing program is third largest in the country, and we do have that National Center for Interprofessional Practice and Education. So that gives you an overview of our education and training. In terms of our range of health research, it really does cover the whole spectrum of research, from the most basic biomedical science research to clinical population, patient outcomes, healthcare delivery, and policy. Our health, what characterizes health research in general, it is extremely highly competitive environment. NIH funding, for example, which provides about $30 billion in medical biomedical research, has been flat and is extremely competitive, as I'll show you. It is externally peer-reviewed. It's highly regulated. It's also expensive in terms of faculty, staff, facilities, and equipment. And there's a long timeline from initial idea to proof to adoption and practice. We do use rigorous scientific methods that are required for proof, but it's a high-risk activity. Everybody should realize that there for all the projects and research projects that are funded, there are not that many that actually are home runs that result in a cure. I mean, I think everyone is aware that the war on cancer started in 1971 with Richard Nixon, and here we are 44 years later, and while we've made some progress, we clearly do not have a cure for most cancers. So it's a difficult area, but we must keep investing in it, I think, if we're going to continue to make progress. Our academic health center-wide health research priorities primarily involved cancer, neurological diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, cardiovascular, diabetes, obesity is a big problem. 27% of all 65-year-olds now have diabetes. Infectious disease, we need to be vigilant about influenza, for example, which has been a killer lately. And, of course, there's always the recent risk of Ebola. And pediatrics, we have focused a lot in these areas. These do require a number of areas of infrastructure to support that, from health informatics to genomics, proteomics, drug discovery, development. We're involved in all of these areas.
Our research is funded, as I said, primarily through competitive grants and contracts through the National Institutes of Health. We do get some indirect cost recovery on grants and contracts that do help support this infrastructure. We do get state appropriations, so which we're very appreciative of in a number of areas. Clinical revenues certainly help to subsidize our research. Gifts and endowments, business and industry contracts, we're very fortunate. There are some 400 medical device companies in this state, which we work with quite a bit, which is, it's a great partnership, and I think, you know, these investments in research do result in a lot of economic development and jobs in these health-related industries for Minnesota. And then royalties and licensing fees, we've had some major successes in the past and are still investing in this area for patents in the future. The next slide shows that I've used fiscal year 13 numbers because they've already been compiled and used before, but you can see we have approximately a total of almost $400 million in research funding, of which approximately $324 million is sponsored research as opposed to non-sponsored research, which is mostly through philanthropy. And the next slide shows our research expenditures in thousands, showing the medical school with about $188 million being the largest. But all of our schools are very active in research, as you can see. And the AHC makes up approximately 52% of all the research by dollar at the university as a whole, which has about $721 million. So we are a real driver of economic development and workforce training in very capable, competent professionals and scientists in this area, too, which I think strongly benefits the state. One can see this just breaks down where our funding specifically comes from our different sponsors, again, with Human Health Services at the federal level, NIH, HRSA, and others being the largest by far. However, it is getting more difficult. Adjusted for inflation, the NIH budget has decreased in real terms by 22% in the last 10 years. The number of competing research project grants has also fallen sharply from about a 20% decrease in the last 10 years. The awards for investigator-initiated grants, which means these are the R01 type grants where it's not in response to a specific request for a proposal, but just initiated by the investigator, has fallen by some 34% in the last 10 years. Our NIH research rankings overall are quite excellent. One can see here the ranking and the denominator are the number of schools in this area. So, for example, the medical school is ranked 30th out of 144 medical schools. We're in the 21st percentile. We can see the School of Public Health is in the top 10th percentile, for example. But the University of Minnesota as a whole, with a denominator of some 2,336 universities in the United States, we are in the top 1% overall. But this next slide just shows the number of research applications and the funding success rates. And one can see that the number of applications have gone up, the money has stayed flat, and therefore the success rate of grants funded has dropped from about 31% to 17.7% over that time period in 10 years. The trends in health research are becoming more team-based science, more interdisciplinary, multi-institutional, global. Informatics, big data, genomics, personalized medicine, greater emphasis on reducing time from research to adoption. I think everyone has seen a lot of this in the press. It's very true. You know, if you want to sequence the human genome, that's a big deal. It's a lot of money and time. It took 10 years to do this and billions of dollars, although we can now do it in a day for about $5,000. So it's amazing how the technology is really improving dramatically. But we can do a lot more, but it does require larger, more expensive infrastructure and bigger teams given the expertise in all these different areas that are needed to address these really grand challenges in biomedical research. So what are our strengths in the changing research world? We are one of the most comprehensive academic health centers in the nation. We have a strong history of interdisciplinary research. I think everyone knows about the first to do the cardiac bypass that Walt Lillehei was involved in, and our pancreas transplants. We have a very strong history in this area, and we still have programs of centers of national strength currently. We have made great investments in thanks to the state in terms of our biodiscovery district and our laboratories and infrastructures for basic research. And we have made a number of investments in infrastructure besides laboratories, but also in our genomics, informatics. We have a large presence internationally, both in Africa and Asia. In particular, where we do a lot of really top infectious disease research in the area of, say, malaria and tuberculosis, HIV. In terms of patient care, this is our third part of our what we call the tripartite mission of research, education, and clinical care, and providing top quality care. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you in mid-sentence, but we have a question just before we get into this next section from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I did want to ask a brief question before we go on to the next section, if that's okay, just over what you just covered, Dr. Jackson, and a couple things. Just so I understand what is on your slides here, where you have the NIH research rankings, mm-hmm. I assume the rankings are in terms of dollars received?
Dollars, funding, I'm sorry, it's okay. Funding.
Okay, and then the other question I had is on your slide that shows the breakdown of the sponsors of the research. And you have here about close to $14 million that comes from the state of Minnesota. And I wonder if you could just give us a bit more information about what are we funding in that $14 million.
Okay. Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and Representative, so a couple of the bigger special projects that the state funds. One is the recent, last year, the regenerative medicine funding that serves not just the University of Minnesota, but Mayo is involved, as well as other institutions or individuals can apply for regenerative medicine type. They can submit research proposals for this. And that was approximately $5 million a year. And then there's the, I'm blanking on the actual technical name, but it's the genomics, biomedical genomics partnership with Mayo Clinic. And that has been in place for about 10 years. It's been an extremely good return on investment for that, resulting in, I believe, some $110 million in NIH funding as a result of that investment. So those are the two primary funding that you funded that have make up that $14 million.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief follow-up to that. Both of those categories, I would say, are they're not types of funding where the state of Minnesota is kind of telling the university what it should be researching, correct? They're more for categories of research where the university or in partnership with Mayo or however it is decides what should be funded. So I just kind of want to I'm bringing this up because we've heard a proposal that includes funding, for example, for Alzheimer's research. Mm-hmm. And I want to just get sort of a handle on, I think that would be kind of a new thing for us if we were to say, here's a bunch of money that people can apply to research a particular disease. And so I just wanted to see if I'm correct that would be sort of a new leap. Because if the two things that you've just mentioned are indeed the whole of what Minnesota funds in terms of research, then I think we're looking at a different animal if we step into this idea of going after a particular research problem with state money. Am I correct in that?
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair, I mean, in general, the state, to my knowledge, has not funded research for a specific disease. I mean, regenerative medicine could be researched in many different types of diseases, and same with genomics that can basically cover many, many different things. So, and it does give the flexibility as the science changes over time to be able to more direct it to maybe the most promising areas of medicine and research. I mean, having a disease-specific research area, I understand why some people, you know, that's important. Clearly, Alzheimer's is a very important disease that affects many, many elderly people. So I'm always supportive of Alzheimer's disease research money, but it is an issue if one starts going down by everybody has their favorite disease, and it, you know, it probably gets complicated doing it that way. So,
it's a good question, Representative Leland.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Brooks. You can continue.
Yes. So moving on to patient care on slide 34. Patient care, as you might imagine, is very critical to the success of academic health center schools. We do provide top quality care to Minnesotans as part of the academic health center in terms of education and training of health professional students for good clinical care, for clinical research and translation to practice, recruiting and retaining top faculty, financing the academic mission. Half of the AHC's budget comes from seeing patients, actually. So it is a large part of our center. The University of Minnesota Health is a statewide resource for patient care, from primary care to specialized care. As I mentioned, we have over 1 million patient visits in our clinics and hospitals. The University of Minnesota Medical Center is part of Fairview Health Services, is the primary teaching hospital. University of Minnesota Physicians is the second largest integrated practice in Minnesota, with well over 1,000 physician faculty alone, as well as other non-faculty physicians. The School of Dentistry, their students and faculty clinics see more than 100,000 patients annually. They have outreach partnerships with clinics in the Twin Cities and across the state, but would like to greatly expand those in greater Minnesota. The School of Nursing is opening a nurse-managed primary care clinic in March down by the new stadium going up there on Fifth Street. They have a faculty practice in psych and mental health and primary care, women's health, and pediatric care as well. The College of Pharmacy provides state-of-the-art medication therapy management program in partnership with 6 healthcare systems across the state and manages a medication therapy management network serving some 35,000 University of Minnesota employees and their family. This is an area that's really expanding. So, for example, managing medication for diabetics, and you know, doctors may use, or physicians used to do more of that, and now pharmacists are doing that quite capably, more efficiently, and more affordably for patients as well. We also have clinical practices in all the AHC schools. We have a community university health care center called COOC that provides medical, dental, and mental health services in the Phillips neighborhood of Minneapolis. This is very important, not only for these underserved urban areas, but how to train our health professionals to work in these areas. It serves very low-income and recent immigrant patients, of which we are seeing much greater numbers than, say, 20 years ago. We have more than 63,000 patient visits annually at this clinic, and services are provided in 7 languages. It's a major training site with more than 225 students and residents annually at this clinic. The College of Veterinary Medicine is one of the largest and most advanced veterinary hospitals in the world. It sees more than 35,000 patients and animals annually, and is a full-service referral center for small and large animals, and is well known for its very specialized equine horse clinic. The national trends are such that hospitals, clinics, and health systems need to reduce costs to compete in the market. needs to have closer integration of education, research, and care, closer integration of governance, organizational, and administrative structure to align strategy and operation, and have a faster track to move research discoveries to practice. We are, our whole setting is providing care is moving more towards outpatient as opposed to hospital. It's more preventive medicine than before to keep people healthy from getting sick in the first place. But we need to be able to try new therapies faster and in these outpatient settings so that they become more available for people all over the state, not just in our specialized centers. So we are using new models of interprofessional team-based education, training, and practice, and as I said, a focus on wellness and population health. The future of patient care at University of Minnesota is challenging with reduced reimbursement rates, intense market competition, high demand. University is well positioned, though, for the future. We do have, as I said, a strong history of innovation in interprofessional team-based care, and all of our schools are planning to grow their clinical practices and are examining opportunities to increase collaboration and integrate practices across the schools to better serve Minnesotans throughout the state of Minnesota. We are focused on the triple aim of improved access, improved patient quality and experience, and reduced cost. The UM Health we'll open a new ambulatory care clinic in January 2016 on the university campus on the East Bank in the Twin Cities, which will replace outdated overcapacity clinics and improve service, longer hours, and new models of care. Our commitment as the state's land-grant university and only research university is that the U of M plays an essential role in the health of Minnesota, in educating, training the state's health professional workforce, discovering new treatments, cures, and ways to promote health, helping shape health policy, developing and piloting new models of care, and providing top-quality health care services to the state. We are committed to continuing that work and meeting the challenges ahead in the changing world of health care and an aging population and health care disparities in particular. The governor's committee on the medical school that Madam Chair mentioned was started in August 2014, just about 5 months ago. Governor Dayton issued an executive order forming the Blue Ribbon Commission on the Medical School with the instruction to focus on the following goals: national prominence, ensuring the medical school's national preeminence by retaining and attracting world-class faculty, staff, students, and residents. Nation-leading research and innovations, sustaining this university's national leadership in healthcare research, care innovation, healthcare delivery, and capitalizing on the state's investments in biomedical research and groundbreaking discoveries. Excellence in clinical services, expanding the university's clinical services to strengthen its ability to serve as a statewide healthcare resource for providers and patients, as a training site for health professional students and residents, and as a site for cutting-edge clinical research, and as a source for critical funding for the medical school and health sciences. And lastly, the last charge was in order to meet the healthcare needs of a changing Minnesota, how do we address the state's healthcare workforce needs so as to serve Minnesota's broad continuum of healthcare needs, including primary care, a growing aging population, and increased chronic health needs. The Blue Ribbon Committee was made up of university leaders, health system, and other private sector leaders, legislators, Madam Chair was one of the members, state officials, health professional associations, and patient representatives. The Governor's Committee recommended the funding of medical discovery teams, which would consist of 10 medical discovery teams of 10 tenure track faculty each, who are NIH funded, to focus on a specific challenge that we would become really world-class in that area. This would allow us to restore the medical school's NIH funding ranking to its 1990 levels and increase our number of faculty there, with the target for being in the top 20 in 5 years. There was also some money there for biospecimen depository, clinical repository as well. The workforce issues recommendations were to expand the Rural Physician Associate Program, which gives stipends to medical students who spend 9 months in these rural areas. Half of those will stay in those areas, so that has been a really good return on investment, although the stipend hasn't changed since 1971. So in terms of real dollars, it's really gone down in value. So to increase that and increase the numbers was part of that, as well as what we call MetroPAP, getting physicians to be able to work in these underserved urban areas was part of it as well. The Duluth Rural Scholars Program and clinical facility for the medical school in Duluth, which would also encompass the College of Pharmacy, would benefit from that as well. Expanding pipeline programs for more health professionals and how we train them, and scholarships for underrepresented populations, as our Minnesota is greatly rapidly diversifying its population, especially among young people. And then a recommendation for a health science clinical research building. Our facilities are quite outdated. They're quite old, our health science education, and we really don't have enough space for clinical research, which the companies in the Twin Cities in particular, all these medical device companies, do a lot of their clinical research outside of Minnesota and even outside of the country, because we don't have enough facilities to do the clinical trials that they would like done. I've met with a number of CEOs of these companies, and they would very much like to keep the research here in the Twin Cities as well. And then funds for planning a new health sciences building in Duluth was part of those recommendations. And then lastly, I know this committee is the policy committee. However, I'd like to take a couple slides to tell you about the health sciences part of the university's 2015 biennial budget request, which was to focus on and have funding for the statewide network of interdisciplinary primary care teaching clinics. If one wants to, as I said, we have trouble finding models of care for training our students in some of these interdisciplinary primary care areas. So funding would allow us to set up some of these clinics or work with existing clinics to expand this model. Money for expanding education training programs to address shortages, particularly in dentistry, which is really woefully short in rural areas. Mental health and geriatrics, as has been mentioned. And encourage students from underrepresented communities to pursue health professional careers, and increase scholarships and loan forgiveness programs for students who choose to work in underserved communities. And last slide, investments in research and new models for care and health promotion. There is a particular, these chronic diseases are consuming a tremendous amount of the healthcare dollar. And if we can prevent these diseases in the first place or treat them more inexpensively, that would be a big help. And then creation of a Minnesota electronic health library. And to tell you more about that component of the Healthy Minnesota biennial request, I can now turn the presentation over to Janice Jagoszewski, and so I would thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to take any questions before Janice does this presentation. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Jackson. Are there any questions from members? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I think Representative Mulry's first.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Dr. Jackson, I'm going to go way back to a slide where we're talking about the challenges that we face in health education. You note on your slide the difficulty in finding or training practice sites that model healthcare the way it should be delivered. Mm-hmm. And then on italics you say working in teams with providers practicing at the top of their license.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you could briefly just unpack that statement for me.
Dr. Jackson.
So I think 30, 40 years ago, physicians, for example, did much of the interaction with a patient in a clinic from taking their blood pressure, to pulse, to even taking their temperature at times. You know, things have clearly evolved since that time, in which you know, pediatricians did well baby checks, and now in order to be for them to be able to see more patients and to do this more affordably, we have used other health professionals such as nurses or pharmacists to provide some of the care with good training they can do competently, allowing, say, for example, physicians to, when we say practice at the top of their license, focus on those activities that are more highly specialized to require more expertise, allowing them, again, to see more patients and do this more affordably as well, and lowering the cost of care with that, as well as being able to, especially this becomes more important where there are physician shortages.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then to your next slide, where you kind of outline what we have done. You note in there that you've created or maybe expanded the use of the Doctor of Nursing Practice. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, maybe my naivete will show with this next statement, but to the extent of, are we talking about a peer-to-peer between an MD and a DNP? And when we talk about the scope of practice, mm-hmm. are we talking about going down the same road with a DNP as we have seen with MDs, where they specialize as opposed to stay in the more generalist approach or internal medicine? Does that go to compensation? Does it go to advanced practice mechanism specialization? And to the extent that it is being done candidly to possibly address the deficits we're seeing in rural healthcare? I know it's a big question.
I think, Madam Chair, I am representative. I think it is a combination of all of those things. I think in some cases the advanced nurse practitioners, for example, are doing general, you know, seeing primary care, providing primary care type care as opposed, but there are advanced nurse practitioners that are becoming specialized in some areas. I think it's still pretty general overall, but there is some of that specialization, which in some ways it there are still would be differences in compensation, but obviously would raise the compensation of those specialists, advanced nurse practitioners to some extent. But again, we also have shortages in certain specialty areas. It's not just primary care. I mean, anybody who tries to get an appointment with a dermatologist this day can understand. I mean, there are some real shortages in orthopedics. I mean, almost everybody over 60 has to see a dermatologist or has arthritis of some sort or some bad knee, back. I mean, there are. So I don't want to just focus on the deficit in primary care. There are some areas of specialty deficits as well, whereas advanced nurse practitioners and other health professionals can help relieve those shortages as well.
Representative Albright.
So then to the question I asked in terms of the balance between, you know, is it a peer-to-peer in terms of, if you could discuss just the scope of practice between an MD and a DNP?
Well, so, Madam Chair and Representative, in general, for by far the majority, these DNPs do work with physicians or under the supervision, in many cases, of a physician. Now, the increased scope of practice in some cases, nurses, there is still some limitation, but they can practice independently. That is becoming more common. But I think the more common model is that a DNP, advanced nurse practitioner, do work with physicians or under the direct supervision of a physician.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you speak about limitations, mm-hmm. and again, unpack that statement in terms of what limitations would be imposed besides under, are you talking about the direct supervision, a consultative supervision of a medical practitioner, an MD, or what is the relationship between those two as it would pertain to an advanced nurse practitioner?
Dr. Jackson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative. So it will vary. So, for example, at the University of Minnesota Health, a nurse advanced practitioner could practice as a medical staff on her own without the direct supervision of a physician if her or his scope of practice was what they did was approved by the medical board. So they would limit what that advanced nurse practitioner could actually practice, and it will vary by what they want to do. So there's no sort of hard and fast rule that a nurse can only do this or only do that. This will be determined by, for example, the medical executive board of a health system or a hospital. If they practice totally independently of a physician but are part of overall medical staff. In other cases, what they can do, if under the supervision of a physician, will be determined in large part, again, by that medical board and by that particular physician. You have to understand that, I mean, medical practice varies considerably, the type of practice. And so each case is going to be somewhat different.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then, pertaining to the scope of practice that they would be following, do they get to choose which board they are subservient to? Or can they jump back and forth? Or once they go to the DMP, are they under the purview of the medical board, or they can oblige themselves on the nursing board? Or where does that bright line exist?
Dr. Jackson.
Well, most are part of healthcare systems, so they're under an overall system board, as are the physicians as well, and all the credentialing that would go with that as part of when I say independent physician, in that they can practice without being under the supervision directly of a physician, but they're still part of a system. I am not aware of exactly how it works if they're in a totally independent practice affiliated with no system or hospital. I just don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mulry, and we'll get through these next few questions and then get on to our last testifier. Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jackson, I saw something in here that concerned me, that the university med schools ranked 30th. And I know when I went to law school at the U, it was ranked anywhere from 5th to 8th in the country. Now they brag they're in the top 25. And then when I worked in the university attorney's office, I was assigned to the med school and the hospitals. And we were also the coordinator for all the university attorneys in the country. And in talking to people all over the country, it was always right around 6th or 7th in med school, and sometimes 4th or 5th, never below the top 10. What did we do wrong to get out of there, and how can we back there?
Dr. Jackson.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think there are several things. Clearly, I mean, I did my residency over 30 years ago, and we were ranked much higher than we are now. That's true. I think several factors probably have played a role in this. One is in the 90s, we lost a number of tenure track faculty. When you say ranked, we're going by the NIH funding specifically here. When you say 25th or 30th, that's in terms of NIH funding. I do think there are other sorts of rankings, and it is true that I know the governor in particular has said that when he was interested in medical school, it was ranked 8th, I think, in the 60s or so. So I think losing those tenure track faculty made a big, big difference, and partly the medical school had a number of financial problems in the 90s, a number of scandals. No, I wasn't here during that time, but apparently it really did affect our ability to recruit and retain faculty. There were financial issues, so I think some of that with the healthcare system changes and the access to some of the clinical revenues with the sale of the hospital. I think there were several factors. I don't think there's any one factor, but I think all of those things are on a much better trajectory right now in terms of our ability to recruit, our relationship with the Fairview system. You know, things are clearly positive, and I think with this proposal in the governor's budget and following the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon Committee of being able to hire, we had asked for 100 tenure-track faculty. His proposal is 50, which is will still be very helpful. So I think that will very much help us get back. And ultimately, we want to be in the top decile, meaning of 144 medical schools, at least in the top 13 or 14, and I would hope the top 10 within the in the next 8 to 10 years.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a quick thing to the Chair. Last session, we had quite a few pieces of information, the state by county with how many doctors, which specialties, NPs, and et cetera. It, with the scope of practice that was changed, it'd be nice to get an update that might help us analyze the different types of resources across the state. And then to Dr. Jackson, the dentists, and you showed some higher level information, but I know from experience that there are practices that close due to the below cost reimbursement structure and the demographics in different counties and regions of the state. Do you know if there's any information about the, I guess, salary, effective salary in different parts of the state due to the demographics and the below cost reimbursement structure for a large portion of some of those populations?
Dr. Jackson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, I do not know the specifics. I do know that it, generally the reimbursement rates are lower, and it is a factor. I know especially among dentists, this is a real problem in greater Minnesota. Dean Leon Asale, who is the dean of the dental school, is very passionate about this issue and very much would like to see that corrected in terms of the ability to get dentists there, whether it's through better reimbursement or our training programs, incentives to do that, because unfortunately in greater Minnesota we really rank extremely poorly in terms of oral health.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If there's some way that we could get some data on that, because MA and other things, I know we had some testimony from parts of that equation, but it'd be nice to pull something together, because that, as has been mentioned by the testifier, is a major issue to many of us and our citizens.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Great point. Representative Mazin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jackson, in regard to the doctor shortage, I had asked some questions a while back, and I'm told that we can be graduating people to be doctors, but one of the main criteria or the things that is holding it back is getting residencies. And I understand that's a major financial issue, but what steps are being done to address that?
Dr. Jackson.
So, Madam Chair and Representative, in general, for the country as a whole, there are more residency slots than U.S. medical graduates. However, by specialty or area, it does differ, and not all U.S. medical graduates can get residency slots. The demand is higher, or the way graduate medical education is funded, which is to hospitals typically, which tend to be in urban areas as opposed to rural areas, there are fewer primary care residency slots than are needed. So that is correct, what I think you are saying. So how to correct that? The Institute of Medicine has recently issued a report recommending that graduate medical education funding, which goes to hospitals primarily now, go to the sponsoring medical institutions, such as the medical school, which would then decide where the needs really are, and would contract then with, say, primary care clinics and rural clinics to be able to provide funding for training sites, residency slots in those areas. Because right now, most of them are confined to large hospitals, actually. And so our residents are still spending a lot of time in hospitals as opposed to outpatient and primary care type areas.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we've heard in past presentations, I think most recently by Dr. Ed Allinger, who used to be part of your academic health center, about how the improvements, both in terms of reducing health care costs and improving people's quality of life and longevity, have primarily come through population health efforts through public health. And your data here shows that is actually your most successful component in terms of getting outside NIH funding. And yet I see so little emphasis in your plans for the future on really leading the nation on that preventative area, which has so much promise for both improving people's lives and reducing our health care costs, which is something that the whole legislature is interested in the Human Services Committee helping address. Can you tell me a little bit about what your vision is for the School of Public Health and how it fits within this?
So, Madam Chair and Representative, I couldn't agree with Dr. Ellinger more. I think healthcare disparities in particular is one of the biggest reasons we have a gap in our life expectancy in the state. So, for example, in the Cook Clinic, which I mentioned down in the Phillips neighborhood, the life expectancy is 13 years less than if you live around Lake of the Isles, for example. And with these larger immigrant populations in particular, as well as some of our underrepresented minorities that live in this state, addressing that gap could do a tremendous amount to increasing life expectancy for the average life expectancy overall, even though we are already one of the longest lived populations of states in the United States. This is an area we are paying a lot of attention to. As you mentioned, we have one of the largest NIH-funded healthcare disparities grants in the United States of medical schools. We are very much focused on this area, as is the School of Public Health under Dean Finnegan, and we have building a lot of education in our curriculum regarding social determinants of health. Probably 70% to 80% of life expectancy is actually more a function of social determinants as opposed to the treatments we provide. So working with our social sciences at the university, as well as School of Public Health, as well as the business school, we are using all the, not all, but many of the resources we have at the university to address this issue very specifically.
Okay, and I understand, I know we're starting to run short on time, both for you, Dr. Jackson, and we have another testifier that we need to bring forward. So if we could do that now, and then members, if we have any final questions, we'll get those in at the end. So with that, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Madam
Jackson.
Chair.
Appreciate you taking the time. And I'm going to pass on trying to pronounce your last name for just for right now. If you could just give a brief lesson in the pronunciation, and then I'll give a crack at it. So if you could introduce yourself for the record and give us your presentation, please.
Great. Well, thank you, Dean Jackson, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I am Janice Jagoszewski, Director of the Health Sciences Libraries at the University of Minnesota, and I'm delighted to be here today to tell you about our proposal for a Minnesota Electronic Health Library, and we affectionately refer to it as MEL. So we know that effective health care requires access to reliable, high-quality health information to support decision-making around diagnoses and treatments, all the things that Dr. Jackson has been discussing. And so you may be wondering, why are we seeking funding for online health information? Isn't it freely available on the web? And I'm here to tell you, no, it is not. Unequivocally, no. high-quality, professional-level health information is extremely costly, and it's available only through expensive licenses from publishers. And to just give you an example of that, in the biomedical library at the University of Minnesota, I have a number of journals that cost $10,000 to $20,000 apiece. So that just gives you a sense of what we're talking about. And when you look at more specialized types of online resources, and that's also what I'll be talking about here, they can be even more expensive. And because of these costs, therefore, health information, this type of professional-level health information is out of the reach for most people in Minnesota. And that includes many healthcare providers, particularly in the rural outstate. So our solution is the Minnesota Electronic Health Library. MEL would provide all Minnesotans with 24/7 access to reliable, high-quality health information and the latest medical research in support of evidence-based practice. And when we refer to evidence-based practice, we mean finding the best evidence to inform diagnoses and treatments. We know that medical research is constantly making new discoveries. We learn about things all the time. And what was best practice 2 years ago changes, and doctors are then making different recommendations 2 years later. So as patients, of course, we want them to have this type of information. We don't want them relying on what they learned 20 or 30 years ago when they went through medical school or through their own residency. We want them to have the latest. So if funded, MEL would provide a single point of online access to a core set of clinical information resources available from work, home, campus, or library 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The resources are comprehensive, up to date. They're easily searchable and in an understandable format. And I think that is also key. If you've ever done lots of searching on the web, you can get all sorts of information. But this really gets you to the information you're looking for and need, and it would be available to all Minnesotans. I did include a handout in your packet that outlines the types of resources that we are interested in as we have been talking to health science librarians and providers throughout the state. So that one specialized resource that I do want to highlight is called an evidence-based point-of-care tool. We're not yet recommending any specific resources until we would be able to actually talk to vendors. But one that we are looking at offers over 3,200 topics that provide synthesized information in support of clinical decision making. It's based on surveillance of over 500 key journals. And physicians actually critically appraise those articles and select the best evidence and make it in provide it in an easily searchable format. We're also looking at professional drug or pharmaceutical reference, full-text books and journals. I am frequently contacted by those outside the university asking for access to those books and journals online, and the publishers, we restrict access to just university affiliates, and a nursing database, because we also have nursing programs not only at the university but at 35 institutions across Minnesota, and it really varies as to what they have access to. So I am probably not the only one in this room who has gone online to look for information, trying to diagnose something that is happening either to me or to my family. And so who would benefit from MEL? Everyone, every single one of us. As individuals, we need to be informed so we can be part of the patient-doctor partnership, because that is so important now. You do your research and you come in and you have a conversation and need to make an informed health decision about your own healthcare choices. This is an image of a CT angiogram. It's a little hard to see, but it's a heart. And there's a big artery there that goes down the middle of it. Of course, they put in dye so that you can see it. And there, the arrows are pointing toward a gap there in the middle, and that's a blockage. This heart, that artery, is 95% blocked or occluded. That's a picture of my heart just about a year ago in October. And it was a complete shock to me and to my doctor, the cardiologist that was called in. I had normal blood pressure. I had a cholesterol of 150. I have never smoked. I'm not diabetic. I have two parents who are living in their 80s. And they came in and said, "You are a medical mystery, but we're prepping an OR, and you're going down immediately." And they put in a stent, and I'm doing fabulously, and I'm very grateful. Modern medicine is amazing. And as soon as I got home, I, of course, went online, because why would this have happened to me? I was 48 years old. And I had lots of information at my fingertips because I have access to it through the University of Minnesota. But I was also struck by how many people do not. And then thinking also in terms of physicians who do not, or other providers. And so I began working on this idea about MEL 2 years ago, but a little over a year ago. It went from being a professional project to a very personal one. And when I share that story with people, they come up to me afterward and they share their own, because it's not that unusual that each one of us has a story. Something's happened either to us or to a loved one. So who else benefits? As I mentioned, the rural health providers. And Dean Jackson explained that rural Minnesota is disproportionately impacted by health professional shortages. MEL would provide equal access to clinical information resources regardless of geographic location or institutional affiliation, because typically it's only the large organizations that can afford these types of resources, and thereby promote recruitment and retention of our rural providers. I was talking, he mentioned Dean Asale, who's Dean of Dentistry. He once practiced in a rural area and said how isolating that is. So through information and access to information, you're connecting with experts, people you can call, people you've identified to then follow up on an unusual case. And so I do think that access to information is extremely important and can promote recruitment. Dean Jackson also talked about our mentors or teachers out in the clinical setting. We call them preceptors. They teach our students, and we frequently hear that the preceptors themselves do not have access to the resources that their students have through the University of Minnesota. I was contacted recently by a pharmacy alum who said, gee, when I was in my clinical setting, my residency, people kept asking me to look up information for them and print out the articles, which I don't want to hear, because we're not supposed to do that. So Dean Jackson also just mentioned there at the end, health disparities. This stat is from the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation, and we know, of course, that there are many different factors that contribute to health disparities, but access to the latest medical research, I believe, would really help address that really reinforce best practices in addressing health issues in a similar manner throughout our state. And that is just actually the map. You know, we are emphasizing rural Minnesota, but there are also differences actually right in the metro area between systems. And so that just really reinforces that difference between life expectancy of 70 years and 83 plus, several miles away. Wow. So I will just end with this photo. And just say that MEL will better position health providers, policymakers, researchers, educators, and students to provide evidence-based care, develop programs that improve health outcomes, teach students best practices, and reinforce quality of care in support of a healthy Minnesota. This photo in the center is one of my librarians, Jonathan Koffel. He works with the medical school, and he goes on rounds. We have a number of librarians who are embedded in the clinical environment and in the hospital. He here is working with the neurology residents and demonstrating. As questions come up on the fly, he looks up the information and demonstrates to them how you can do this and how you can answer those questions. And so it's a terrific program. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I appreciate it. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll go with Director. Can you help us feel how compatible is this with the diverse systems that we have between different clinics and hospitals? And then I'm highly concerned about, especially for medical professionals, some of the imaging and video have some specialized files and formats, mm-hmm. and I think we've all opened a browser and been told, well, we need to have this plug-in or compatibility. So how is this addressing if we roll it out?
Sure. So
Ms. Jagoszewski.
Yes. Thank you. Sorry. Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for that question. In terms of all the variation and the differences among all the organizations and institutions, we have been having lots of conversations and really identifying what is needed what is unique and not held in most places. So, in fact, as an example, Fairview is right next door to my library, the University of Minnesota Medical Center, but it is owned by Fairview. So people who work in Fairview, unless you are a University of Minnesota physician affiliated with the university and working in Fairview, you have access to the university's online resources. If you are a nurse working side by side with that physician and are not a University of Minnesota employee, you do not have access to the University of Minnesota's online resources from the hospital. You can come to my library and use them, certainly, but not remotely. And that is, of course, everyone wants remote access. They want online access. So we have had conversations with various care systems and hospitals, so 79 rural hospitals that are out there, and there are key resources that they do not have. There are resources that Fairview UMMC does not have. So that is what we're seeking, to fill that gap. So does that answer your question?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is a good part of the question. The other part is the compatibility system to system. If you're in rural Minnesota or with a clinic or a hospital, you may have a different system, and all of the files and documents might not be compatible if it's a virtual VNP into your network, or have you come up with a solution that's compatible?
So Ms. Bagashevsky.
Madam Chair and Representative, we would certainly be looking at the different situations, but frequently these types of resources are really self-contained. So you're not needing to download something to your computer or to your system. They are self-contained, and you interact with them with that system or that online resource as they are being served up from elsewhere. So that is probably why they cost so much. They are very, very well developed.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Jagoszewski.
Very good. Thank you.
I've heard of it, so I'm so rare. The question I have is more about the different audiences who would be using this resource. When you've got healthcare providers using the same resource as patients are using, do you have different portals for each, or how do you make sure that when I, as a lay person, go on there, that I'm not bombarded with pieces of information that I just don't know how to interpret? And, you know, if you give me the medical articles, I don't know what they mean.
Sure.
How are we dealing with that?
Ms. Jagoszewski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Getting harder for some reason.
Oh, dear.
The more I say
it. I should have put my phonetic spelling, which I frequently give, and I should put that on the slide. So yes, so these are they are specialized resources, but they are also packaged in a way, particularly this point of care tool that is really at the top of our list, so that they are more easily searchable. Yes, there are certainly medical terminology that is included, but that medical terminology is in your health records. They're the terms that your physicians use, and they are linked out then to definitions. They're linked out to the full text of the article. So what it does, for instance, for this particular resource, you could search on a topic, and it will start stepping. And the intention for this use is in the clinical setting, so that it would be very easy for a physician or a nurse or another provider to use a mobile device, to use a laptop, and look up this information on the fly. So the idea is that they don't want someone to be just inundated with lots and lots of information the way you do when you search the web or search something called PubMed, which is a freely available index, but that instead it is synthesized for you. And so that it is much easier to work through how to read that. It takes you right through, first diagnosis. You try these treatments. If that doesn't work, here's the second option. Here's the possibility. Here are these treatments. So I personally have used this and found it to be very, very helpful. So I can go into my doctor's office and say, okay, I know we've tried this. Have we gotten to this point? This is what is being recommended. Here are the articles that support why we should try this approach. For some of the others, the drug references, those are important as well. Again, yes, they will be at a provider level, but again, with a little additional information that, and it links out to that information, I do believe it's accessible.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And do providers seem like they would be happy with patients doing that? I mean, already I think sometimes there's an issue for providers mm-hmm. where the patients come in having read all kinds of stuff on the web, and sometimes providers have to spend time helping them unlearn some of what they think they learned.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm one of them.
So maybe you could address that. No.
Ms. Jagoszewski.
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, indeed. And frequently they want people to unlearn some of the poor information that you find on the web, the unreliable information, the information that they have to convince you is not correct. And these resources would actually, I think, be helpful. These would be highly reliable resources that you could actually have a conversation with a physician about. And as healthcare is changing, I know in my experience now I have younger and younger physicians. I don't know. I feel like my physician's like 20 years old, and they take a very different approach. They are expecting to have that conversation. They're expecting to provide me with a range of options, and then I need to decide. And you know, I think much more responsibility is put on the patient now, and I think it's important for us to be as informed as possible. Mm-hmm. We are also working with public libraries and the public librarians, because frequently people go to the public library for information. They're looking for assistance there, and so we would be doing training with them and working with the public libraries to work with their patrons.
Okay, well, thank you so much for the testimony. It's appreciated and exciting possibilities.
Yep.
So thank you for the information. And members, with that, we are done with our business for the day, with the exception of we need to move and pass the minutes of January 21st. If members have had a chance to look at it, does anyone want to move those minutes?
I'll move the minutes.
Representative Pearson moves the minutes of January 1st. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And members, just for a little bit of groundwork for tomorrow, we're going to be hearing right out of the chute in the morning, or I'm sorry, tomorrow afternoon, Representative Sanders' bill. It will most likely be a fairly brief bill, but we'll be voting on that fairly quickly, and then we'll be having a presentation from the MMA that will dovetail nicely with the presentation from today. So with that, members, thank you very much. We're adjourned.